This is Impact, a look at the things that matter in Nevada. I'm Carrie Kaufman. I-15 was busy this past weekend as people were streaming out of fire-ravaged California to splash in the pools of Las Vegas resorts. Lots of people were splashing in pools and lining up on the strip. Videos surfaced that showed such crowding, I questioned whether they were pre-pandemic archives. Apparently, they were not. Are local businesses doing as well as the Strip seems to be? Is the Strip doing as well as it seemed to be this weekend? In the meantime, Strip employees have been laid off by the tens of thousands, and the Academy Awards announced a new rule this week that is designed to favor films that are more inclusive, behind and in front of the camera. We'll talk to the head of the Writers Guild Committee of Black Writers. That's this week on Impact. But first, the numbers. We're going to go with the COVID update for the week. We are zooming in on 190,000 deaths in the U.S. The way we're going, I'm not going to be surprised if we hit 200,000 by next week. 6.3 million cases have been reported in the U.S. In Nevada, almost 75,000 people have gotten sick and more than 1,400 people have died. In Clark County right now, we are at 300 new cases a day. That is about where we were like beginning of July. By the end of July, we were at 1,400 cases a day. So we are improving, but we went down and we're starting to go up again. The national map has moved since we started doing this in March. Back then, it was New York and California with a belt running through the south mirroring the Black Belt. Now the map shows kind of a backwards checkmark pattern that begins around Minnesota and the Dakotas, then heads southeast and kicks back up into the Carolinas. The only major metropolitan area that is seeing a rise in cases is in Atlanta. You look at the map and you can tell that COVID is hitting rural areas. I'm going to bring in Lisa Mosley right now to talk about all of this news that is going on. Lisa, welcome.
Hey, Carrie, how you doing?
I'm good. So we are not on fire. that is a good thing. But there was a day last week where there was this little pinpoint of a sun and the entire sky was overcast. At first, I thought, oh, we're going to get rain. But no, it was smoke from the California fires. And yesterday or the other day, I'm seeing pictures of orange San Francisco. Like the entire sky was orange. I thought it was a filter that was used in somebody's camera.
Yeah. It's pretty bad. I remember going out into the backyard last week also and thinking, oh, it looks like we're going to get rain.
Yeah.
Except it wasn't rain. It was just so much smoke coming in from California that it just made this smoky overcast. And it actually was kind of spooky a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of spooky a little bit. And I was a little surprised. And to be honest with you, of course, I knew California was on fire, but I did not know to what extent. And so when I found out this was from the smoke and fires in California, I thought, oh my goodness, it must be much worse than I initially thought it was.
Yeah. A friend of mine wanted to go camping and they got to their campsite and ash was falling on them. And they were like, I think we're going to go. Yeah. I think we're just going to go back to the city right now.
I'm like many transplants to Nevada. I'm originally from Southern California. Mm-hmm. So I remember, you know, when it fires there, I remember getting pretty bad and you seeing ash all the way in Southern California. But I know some of the fires, at least I believe it's the El Dorado fire, is in Southern California, Yucaipa area. So that's pretty scary. My parents are still there. Most of my family's still there. And so I'm keeping in touch with them. And so far they're good, but concerned about what's going on.
So was that the fire that was started by the gender reveal party?
Yes, it was the El Dorado fire.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, let's talk about this. Okay. I remember those stick figure families that cropped up in the aughts, right? It cropped up in like around 2005, 2006, and you put them on the back of your vehicle. And they're all white, of course, because your car window is dark, right? So they have to be white.
Right.
But it wasn't lost on me that During this time when those stick figure families cropped up, states around the country, starting with Massachusetts, were legalizing same-sex marriage. Like it seemed to me like this was an advertisement for, well, this is my family, and my family's a normal family, right? Like if I had put my family up there, it would have been seen as some sort of statement, and people would have asked me about it. And all of those families are families where there's a man and a woman, right? There's two people raising two little kids and five dogs, right? But so I was either in a same-sex relationship, and then I was a single mother, and my family did not belong up there. Like I was kind of intimidated. I wasn't going to put that up there. And then now we have these gender reveal parties, just as we're talking about trans people and the notion of gender and how gender is different from sexuality. And suddenly these gender reveal parties are becoming these huge things where they have to like blow something up in order to surprise everybody because your kid has a certain genitals.
You know, and I remember, you know, of course, everybody, when somebody's pregnant, people want to know, is it a boy or a girl? But I feel like even those questions are just within the construct that we've created about what sex is and what gender is. And we all, you know, we know, and there's more conversation about, especially in sociology, that the two are not the same. Gender is not the same as sex. But I thought it was interesting when I was reading an article about the fire and how it got started, that a couple was having a gender reveal. They wanted to reveal the sex of their baby. That was the first time I thought that, but don't these people know that gender and sex is not the same thing?
Yeah, right.
And I feel like society, you know, the powers that be are trying to reinforce to us that yes, this is the same thing, sex and gender. We don't really want any different genders. We don't want to talk about transgender. We don't want to talk about anything. I thought it was interesting that you said this is all cropping up even more so at a time where transgender is being talked about a lot more, particularly violence against trans people, and people are being more accepting of it. Now, all of a sudden, we're seeing more and more and more of this gender reveal. It's just becoming more of a thing. And so I feel like people are just trying to continue to force this down our throats and make it the same thing, when in fact, gender and sex, you know, they're not the same thing.
They're not the same thing.
No.
And I don't think...
Go ahead.
I don't think that the people who did this... we're like, well, we need to make sure that everybody knows that we're heterosexual and our baby is going to be a boy or a girl, right? Like, I don't think they thought about it in those terms. I just think it's interesting that this kind of thing is becoming popular now while this other thing is happening. Like, these are the forces that I'm seeing in our universe that are kind of like pushing each other right now. Also, I kind of feel sorry for them. Like, you know, all they wanted to do was like do a surprise, hey, we're having a girl or whatever it was. And they ended up starting a forest fire. Like nobody.
A whole fire, like over 8,000 acres, I understand, have burned.
Interestingly, I saw a piece today about the NBA. Steve Nash was named coach of the New York Nets. In his first press conference, journalists pointed out that Nash had never, he was an all-star NBA player. He played for the Phoenix Sun, but that he'd never coached in the NBA. And they asked him specifically, do you think you got this job because of white privilege? And he was like, yeah, probably. I definitely skipped a few steps. And so while he still has the job, and I hope he's good at it, I'm not a New York Nets fan, so I hope he's good at it. But I thought it was interesting that they asked, and that he answered so honestly, and that this is not something that would have been even asked or thought of just a few years ago.
You know, I'd be curious to know what the other who the other candidates were.
Yeah, me too.
You know, I think that would help us answer that question a little bit more. Like if we knew who the other, if there were some women or if there were some African Americans.
Well, it's an NBA team. They're not going to hire women. They are not advanced these days.
I was just trying to give them the benefit of the doubt. You know, that's all. That's all I was trying to do.
Hey, we just got women analysts, right? Like, no.
right.
But not that women are not capable of coaching an NBA team. That's a whole other thing, but they're not. But, you know, there was, I did read some reference to his, the naming of him was a surprise because he wasn't on the short list. He wasn't on the speculation list. So I don't, you know, I didn't care enough to really get, you know, what I really cared about was that they asked that question to begin with. But I just thought it was kind of interesting that, you know, the NBA has really, they're the league that has really stepped up. And hopefully, I know that the NFL seems to be stepping up. They are starting their season. We'll see how that goes. But I hope that they follow through. I know that there are people in the NFL who have been wanting to do this for a long time, and they've been shut down by other people in, like, right. you know, Dallas.
Oh, my goodness. Which happens to have been my, I say have been because I'm on the fence now, but that was always my favorite football team. Oof. But I got to tell you, you know, Jerry Jones in his position with kneeling during the national anthem is just kind of pissing me off a lot. And so I'm rethinking that whole thing. I'd like to see us putting some pressure on him to say, you know, you need to allow your players to kneel if that's what they choose to do.
Yeah.
But the position that he's taking is one, put it in the context of ownership, that just brings up a whole different conversation for me.
Yes.
It just seems like that's what this guy thinks he is. Yeah. You know, like not just the owner of this team, but the owner of these people where you can dictate to them what they can and cannot do, which would be their absolute right to do if they wanted to. But you want to put restrictions on them and say, if you do it, you know, you're going to be in violation of your contract, which right. is just crazy to me.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Let's move on to the next thing. One of the things that I also read is that coronavirus may have been in California as early as December. A study of outpatient visits to UCLA affiliated medical centers show that there was a large uptick in people coming in with coughs starting around December 12th and continuing for the next 10 weeks. Which kind of mirrors the coronavirus. There have been people who left CES in January in Las Vegas who went home and got sick with a really high fever and a cough and couldn't breathe. A friend of mine who was working CES, the person he was working with and him both got really sick with corona-like symptoms right after CES was over, and that was in January.
A really good friend of mine who... she will tell you that she believes that she caught COVID back in November. And I remember her saying how sick she was and she was just having this trouble breathing. She's like, this is unlike anything I've had before. She initially thought it was the flu, but then it got worse and she was just having a lot of difficulty breathing. And she was in the house, in the bed for a very long time. And she says, I look back now, she goes, I really think that I had COVID. And as a matter of fact, if I remember correct, she got tested recently for antibodies and she has the COVID antibodies.
That wouldn't surprise me.
That was back in, she says, I had that back in November. You know, this was before the conversation about COVID was happening. But she says, I was sick back then. And she has always been convinced that it was coronavirus.
Interesting. So now that we're talking about coronavirus and people getting sick earlier and what people knew and blah, blah, blah. Right, like the Orange Sun and all of this other stuff that we've been talking about has been totally eclipsed this week by our president on tape with Bob Woodward saying, hey, it's airborne. We know, I just got off the phone with the president of China and he says it's airborne and it's really bad and it's about five times, the infection rate is about five times more than the flu. And all this stuff that he's been saying the opposite of, don't wear a mask.
Yeah, right.
He's now, he admitted to Bob Woodward, which just blows my mind.
Like who would, Bob Woodward, like why would you tell Bob Woodward
I
that?
I don't know.
This guy can just suck information out of anybody.
He can.
And now we have a president and a vice president who is trying to say, well, you know, it didn't affect his response, though they're not saying he didn't say those things, but it didn't affect his response to the country. We still feel like we had the best response and he shut down the country early enough. But really, did you?
No.
That's my question.
And he told people that it was just like the flu and they didn't have to wear masks.
Right.
And if it's an airborne disease, which it is. Then people need to wear masks so that they don't catch the disease and they need to stay in. And there are a lot of people who believed him and threw caution to the wind because...
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think people still are. You know, if the president is saying we don't have to wear a mask and that it's not that serious, why people are taking that to heart. And then he wants to come here and spread. Well, anyway.
Hey, did you ever read the Harry Potter books?
I have not. I've been watching.
Oh, man.
I've caught up on the movies. My honey is a Harry Potter fanatic.
Oh, good. Good. He and I should get together.
I don't know. Because the marathons are on, we're sitting in front of watching Harry Potter all day.
Okay. So you know the one where Snape is trying to make Harry close his mind to Voldemort. And he's teaching him lessons and it totally backfires. I feel like that's Bob Woodward. Like Bob Woodward gets in a room or on the phone with somebody and he just like reaches into their minds and makes them feel so comfortable that they share things that they would never have shared. Like who in his, he gave 18 interviews to Bob Woodward. Who in their, what politician in their right mind? You help politicians run for office. There's no way that you're going to tell a politician that you're working for to go and talk to a journalist about anything they want to talk about 18 different times as during a race. Yes.
But you use an interesting term here in their right mind. You know, but I think that is an expression of the arrogance of our president. He wanted to feel important, and who better to do that with than Bob Woodward, and to say, I did all of these things. You know, we developed a nuclear weapon, and I did all of these things, and this is what I think. He tried to be smart, but not knowing that it was going to come back and bite him in the butt later.
Which goes to what I've been saying for a while is that he's a seven-year-old child. He's an overly spoiled seven-year-old child.
Well, no, let's not insult seven-year-old children, Carrie. Let's not do that. So I don't even want to say he's a seven-year-old child because, you know, there are some seven-year-olds who are a lot smarter.
Okay. Point
so
taken.
I don't know what to call him, but yeah, I don't want to insult any seven-year-old children out there.
Okay. So before we go on to the rest of the show, I want to talk to you about a little bit about what you're doing. Which is fines and fees. This is something I've reported on off and on over the years, but talk to me about this.
Very excited to do so. So I've newly been named the Nevada State Director for an organization called the Fines and Fees Justice Center. And it's an organization that works solely to eliminate fees associated with the criminal justice system and to make fines more proportionate to populations and make fines more just. And we are working feverishly right now on traffic violations to eliminate things like debt-based driver license suspensions and warrants issued for traffic violations. And what we ultimately want to do is eliminate all of the fees that come with things like being on probation or parole. I didn't even know that when you're on probation or parole, some kind of supervision, that there's a monthly fee that the person being supervised has to pay.
No.
When you get a traffic ticket, there are all these extra fees that are associated with your traffic ticket. Your ticket could be $200, but by the time they tack on administrative assessments, which are statutorily enacted, by the way, and by the time they tack on all these court authorized fees, you could end up paying hundreds of dollars more than what your initial fine was. And what's happening, what we're seeing, is that people are not able to afford all of those fees along with those fines. And put that in the context of COVID, and it makes it even worse. People are trying to survive. And guess what? Jurisdictions, courts are still issuing warrants for people's arrest. People are still being pulled over. And what happens then is now it's increasing the interaction with law enforcement. And sometimes that turns violent and that turns deadly. And in a time where the national conversation, even the international conversation, is about reducing interactions with law enforcement and the possibility of violence, we think that this is a timely conversation. And it's a time now to just revisit, eliminating those things completely, getting rid of warrants for traffic violations. And fortunately, Carson City, in their courts, they stopped doing that back in 2019.
Carson City, the actual city.
Carson City, yes. Their municipal and justice courts no longer issue warrants for outstanding traffic violations.
Okay, so
they are the only ones.
So this is a these are laws that you're talking about. So the people who visit Carson City every couple of years, they're going to have to do something about that.
There is AB 434 that passed out of the last legislative session. It does some things like enacts a ability to pay assessment before warrants are issued. But we don't know if courts are doing that. We don't know if they're doing an ability to pay assessment. It enacted a 30-day grace period for somebody who fails to appear in court. But we don't know if once somebody fails to appear, if the courts are sending them a notice to say, hey, you missed your court date. Here's a new one. Come on in. We don't know what they're doing. We haven't been able to figure that out yet. You know, COVID, courts are just closed. But I have had the opportunity to talk with the court administrator in Carson City, who they like proactively stopped issuing warrants for outstanding traffic violations way last year. And they have what I think should be a model for other courts to implement of how they're doing that instead and how they're getting people to pay their fees and pay their fines. They're waiving fees. They're not issuing warrants at all.
So what's the next step? How do you stop this from happening in other jurisdictions?
Well, the next step is to find some legislators that are willing to write a bill or some bills that will eliminate these things. And the process of that, you know, we need to take to them the research. We need to take to them showing what other courts around the country are doing, how they're generating revenue versus in charging people all of these fees. And we do have some models. There are some courts who are, Nevada's only one of 13 states that still criminalize traffic tickets. All the rest have stopped doing it. So there are models around the country. So we're presenting those models. We're doing the research here, like with Carson City, and talking to other courts and finding out what are some of the other things that they could be doing and that they're willing to do, and presenting that to the legislature. And then finding legislators who will be willing to write the bills and see if we can get them passed. And, you know, so far we've talked to a few legislators who all the ones that we've talked to agree, like, this is a heinous practice. Nobody has resources to be able to do this. But the courts also know that they want to continue offering some of the specialty courts to communities and getting people help. And they think that this is the best way to fund those courts. So we have to find some alternate funding methods.
Lisa Mosley is a state director for the Fines and Fees Justice Center. She is also a recurring co-host here on Impact. I very much appreciate this, Lisa. And thank you for coming on.
Always a pleasure, Curie. Always a pleasure.
Businesses around Clark County are closing, especially bars, which Governor Sisolak has blamed for spreading the virus, and small performance venues, which Governor Sisolak doesn't seem to think exist. As the PPP program runs out for many businesses, with no federal replacement in sight, establishments that have been able to stay afloat are in danger of sinking. Peter Guzman is the executive director of the Latino Chamber of Commerce. Peter, welcome.
I love speaking to you and really enjoy this. And I think the community really needs to clearly remember this moment. Mm. These are moments of lessons, man. And if we don't learn from these moments, we'll get left behind. It's interesting in the Hispanic community, you know, you have extremes. You have some restaurants that have closed and or are struggling, but then you have, you know, your landscapers, you know, it's business as usual because people are still finding a way to maintain their, you know, landscaping, gardeners, even some housekeepers are still doing well, janitorial.
Right.
Construction type industries are still doing okay, although that is slowing down a bit. But it's mostly really your restaurants that are, you know, restaurants, food and beverage is having a hard time right now.
The Las Vegas Strip was busy this past weekend with a lot of maskless people. Swimming pools were busy this past weekend with a lot of people coming in from California. So what's the argument for allowing people to be maskless on the Strip, but closing bars down in Las Vegas proper?
Well, listen, my members are asking that question. great question that's being asked a lot. Now, I don't know if, listen, I don't know if the casinos are just absolutely allowing people to go maskless. I'm not sure. The few times that I've gone out recently to meet with, let's say, Wynn Hotel, everybody I saw was masked. Right. Now, I didn't go out this weekend, and I did see videos of, you know, large crowds and some masked, some not. But I also want to caution you that busy doesn't always mean profitable. Mm. And so I think this weekend taught a lot of folks that very statement, which is, you know, lowering your room rates doesn't mean they're going to go into Louis Vuitton and buy purses or go to the tables and gamble. So I think you're going to see a rethinking of lowering room rates so ridiculously where, you know, you might get a busy crowd, but not a crowd that's spending much money.
Have you been in touch with the governor? Have you at least communicated your message to the governor's office about things like what your members are asking about closing their bars and having 50% capacity at restaurants? Is there any light at the end of the tunnel that you're seeing?
Yeah, so I personally have spoken to the governor and also in groups that I'm in, task force groups, which include other chambers and things of that nature, have all had input. In fact, I feel pretty confident that we stopped the 50% going to 25%. I'm glad we did, because I think that would be I know that would be devastating for a lot of our members and a lot of clients that we have. So, you know, I'm glad we stopped that. But yeah, we have input, but I'm not quite sure if all of our input is being, you know, I adhered to, that's for sure. I mean, and I get it. You know, listen, he's seeing things that maybe we don't see from the medical industry. And so he's got his own worries and fears. But at the end of the day, 3 months ago, I felt one way. But now in September, you know, I'm feeling like we need to start opening up a little bit, because staying closed is having its own set of issues and problems. I'm hearing of, you know, domestic violence going up, child abuse going up. And so, you know, you got to weigh everything out. And we need to try to get back to work as soon as possible. I mean, we're losing conventions. That's risky. They may not come back. We don't know that. We just lost the rodeo, which is, I must have heard from, you know, 500 people today. That is just devastating.
Mm-hmm. But the rodeo, I can't see the rodeo going anywhere else once this is over. You know, I feel like they'll come back to Vegas. What makes you think conventions won't?
Well, listen, I don't want to be negative, because I'm a very positive person, but anytime we lose something, it takes a lot of work to get it back. I mean, we spend a lot of money in getting these groups and conventions. There's a lot of money spent to bring conventions here. And so when you see them leave or cancel, the cancellations worry me a lot, because, you know, then people start saying, well, you know what? We saved X amount of millions of dollars by not having a convention this year. Maybe we won't have that in our budget next year. And then all of a sudden, you know, we're fighting to really get these people back, and we need that. So I'm not saying that we've lost things forever. I'm just saying that when we lose them for a year, it's a little bit risky, and it means we got to fight really hard to get them back. I mean, do you not think that Texas now is going to really go all out for this rodeo to try to keep them for the next X amount of years? We almost lost it once, and thanks to a large part to a real gem that we have in this community named Mr. Gone from the South Point. He fought really hard for us to keep that rodeo.
Mm-hmm. What's going on with PPP? I know that the federal programs are ending, there are a lot of business people who are worried about being able to still pay their employees. We all thought this was going to be done by September. What are your members telling you there?
Yeah, no question that it's running out, and there's a short window, and I hope that people in the power, you know, get their acts together and figure this thing out, because we're not over this by a long shot, and businesses are definitely hurting.
There's two different sort of industries here that we're talking about. And the one that the governor talks about is the resort industry, and there's no doubt it's our biggest industry. But we also have a lot of local stores. And the local stores, you know, dry cleaners are hurting because we're not going anywhere where we have to, you know, wear nice clothes. Restaurants are hurting. The only thing, the business that I see that's doing well are coffee shops, because people still want their coffee. They don't want to make it, and they can drive through. So are you feeling like there is an effort to see the smaller businesses as much as we see the larger businesses?
Yeah, and I think you bring up a good point. And I think that small businesses better wake up and realize that even after COVID, you know, drive-through, curbside, outdoor patio, cleanliness, safety, those are going to be major issues for businesses to be successful in the future. I think people like me are going to continue to enjoy patio, drive-through, and curbside. And I don't think I'm an anomaly. So I think other people are as well. So I caution small businesses all the time to make sure that what they're implementing now, that they even improve on it and realize that it may become part of the business structure in the future.
Yeah, I think there are more businesses that'll say to their employees, hey, you just work from home. Tech businesses are doing well, right? We're ordering all these tech gadgets so that we can work from home and help our kids work from home. But yes, I think that people are going to be, I think this is going to change us for good for a long period of time. But is there a PR campaign that can be done for small businesses that say, hey, we're safe, come back, or bring people in some way?
Yeah, I think that's going to be down the road. I don't think we can do that quite yet. But that's definitely a campaign that's going to have to happen down the road. I'll tell you, you brought up something very interesting that I've been talking about a lot as well. Even before COVID, online shopping has been going up, 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 and up.
Yeah.
And brick and mortar was already hurting, and now they're hurting even more. And now you're getting a whole new group of people that are getting real comfortable with shopping online. And that is having a devastating effect on brick and mortar, which has a devastating effect on real estate and investments and a lot of other things. And so I really encourage some conversations to start being had in D.C., on, you know, what's that going to look like? I mean, are people online paying their fair share? Because it's shutting down businesses. It's time to have these conversations because why wait? I mean, it's happening right now. I ask the same thing about our roads. I mean, yeah, everything's going to electric cars, but at what point are we going to talk about, okay, how are we going to pay for future roads and bridges? So right. I think the same thing about brick and mortar. I mean, you're going to see a lot of places boarded up in the future. You already see big, you know, malls are having a hard time. Mm-hmm. The big anchors are having a hard time. And so I think that COVID has brought this right to the forefront.
Peter Guzman, thank you very much for talking to me.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Carrie. I mean that.
With fires raging in a political and literal sense this week, it may have been easy to miss a decision by the Academy of Motion Pictures. You know, the people who give out the Oscars. In an effort to create more diversity in what we see on screen, the Academy announced that starting in 2024, a Best Picture nominee must have met at least two inclusive standards in four categories. These four categories are on-screen representation, themes and narratives, or the stories we're seeing and the people who are acting in them, creative leadership and project team, you know, the people who come up with the ideas and do the casting, industry access and opportunities, training and hiring people of color, who actually represent a large portion of LA's population, to do work on crew and post-production jobs, audience development, both for the Oscar shows and for future movies, you know, getting Gen Z's attention. According to the LA Times, within each category are a variety of criteria involving the inclusion of people in underrepresented groups, including women, people of color, LGBTQ people, and those with cognitive or physical disabilities. Michelle Amor-Gillies is a writer in L.A. She recently sold her show, The Honorable, to CBS, and she teaches writing at Loyola Marymount. She's also the co-chair of the Writers Guild of America West's Committee of Black Writers. They put out an open letter back in June calling for a change in how writers are hired and for better training to put more minority writers in the pipeline. That letter went viral. I've talked to Michelle before about a racist incident her son had with a teacher, so I sat down with her via Zoom to talk about what these new academy rules meant. She got deep very fast. We had a wide-ranging conversation about what happens in the Black community in Chicago, where she is from and where her show is set, and how so much film and television and journalism we see is about the surface outcomes, not the root causes.
I want to deal with root problems, and that's what the show is about. It's about addressing the root so that you can really solve the problem. You know, these slap the Band-Aid on it, that's not it. And the root problem in Chicago with all the violence is poverty. If they can address some of that poverty, then they can deal with it. And it's such a wealthy city, it's just not balanced. A lot of the money goes into certain neighborhoods, not the Black community.
Michelle and I talked about redlining, a government practice to keep Black people in certain neighborhoods and discourage home ownership. That, Michelle says, is the larger systemic story. But for her show, The Honorable, she's looking to tell the personal stories that spring out of that systemic racism and poverty.
I don't look at it abstractly. I look at it, I'm from the neighborhood, so I can actually apply it to real people. And when you do that, I think that then you can see how it can represent. Good example, I have a cousin. Her son was murdered back in March. Ooh. And it was just really tragic. I mean, he was 25 and it, you know, they still haven't caught the person. But when he died, a lot of people came forward and talked about all the generous things that he had done to just help in the community, right? And one young woman was saying that she had gotten a job and she got the job, but she didn't have the money to get the uniform to start the job. Like, people don't understand poverty. That's poverty, not, oh, I got the job. That's great. It's like she didn't have car fare and she didn't have the uniform. So my cousin, he took her to the store and he bought her, like, you know, two pairs of the tan slacks and I think whatever the top she needed for work. And then he gave her bus fare. But if he couldn't or didn't do that for her, she couldn't have started that job. And that's poverty. It's like, it's like you don't have it and you can't even go to anybody else to get it, right? Because nobody else has it either. And so then you'll have people trying to do something to get, because they're so desperate. It's like, all I need is this. And then all of a sudden, you know, there you go. Now they're in the trouble with the law because they did something like try to snatch a phone to sell it to get the money to get. And when you follow it, you're like, whoa, like, really? Which also says to me, you know, for these jobs, it's like, why don't you provide a uniform if you're hiring? And these companies, especially these multi-billion dollar companies, why don't you offer them uniforms and maybe even a bus card for the first, you know, till they get their first check?
This, Michelle says, is what is fueling her show and is an example of the kinds of stories the Academy may be looking for and why studios need to acknowledge the different perspectives of film and TV makers. She also talked about the meaning of having governing bodies changing behaviors through policies.
A lot of shows that look at the inner city are usually written by people that are not from that inner city. They're observers. You know, even a David Simon with The Wire, he wasn't from that community. He was a reporter, right? And that's a different gaze than when you're on the inside. When you're on the inside, you see people. You don't just see numbers. You don't see statistics. You see your cousin, your mother, your friends. You see real people. And when you do that, you're not so quick to judge or think you know everything. You can look at how complex a situation can be, right? So one of the things that we were exploring, for example, in the show is if somebody dies on the way to the hospital because they don't have hospitals in their community, right? It's mm-hmm. like, that's a real issue. And that has been an issue in Chicago for a long time. First of all, if you have communities that have high levels of violence, that you have to have hospitals. It just is what it is. Until you can tackle the violence, then it's like, at least provide the places where they can go to get treated. It's almost like it's the perfect storm to set people up to die and to fail, you know? It's like, oh, and it makes you, it's like, is this what it's supposed to be? Because that's what it feels like. And I think part of it is really looking at, when you look at systemic racism, like, oh, this is what it's designed to do. And it is the complete disregard for an entire group of people and not looking at the underlying issues and conditions. I saw a video the other day, and it was from a Middle Eastern store owner. And he was saying that it's time for other people of color, for example, to acknowledge that the reason why they can come into Black communities and open up stores is because they are given opportunities that Black people are not. He was like, you should be asking, why aren't there more Black stores in the Black community? And I remember as a kid hearing people say things like, yeah, they'll just give them the money. And I didn't understand that until I got older. For example, even opening up a beauty supply store in the Black community, it's virtually impossible because the Asian community has it on such lock. They actually buy their products all together and they do it in a co-op way, which drives down the prices. So Black people, even if they wanted to open up a beauty supply store in their own community, they can't even afford to get the same products that the Asian store owners get. And to me, that means that something has to change policy-wise. It would have to mean that, okay, if you can't have a monopoly on the entire hair product industry in the Black community, because then it appears as if Black people don't want to own beauty supply stores, and that's just not true. It's just that you literally can't afford to do it because you can't get the products. They won't let you get them, and all the products are coming out of China. So it would have to be somebody actually intervening to change that and saying, listen, you can't do this unless, you know, half of the people that own the shops are also from the community, right? And then that would change things because then people could tap into the cheaper products to then buy them so they can open up their own beauty supplies. One of my friends, Professor Stephen Rogers, he retired from Harvard Business School. He talked of how over the years, he would have Black students always, you know, submit these proposals on like opening up a business. And he would always tell them, you're never gonna open up a beauty supply store in the Black neighborhood, even if you're Black. And that's what I'm saying. Like, why is that a thing? Hmm. Like, how a whole other races come in and take control of an entire industry that completely caters to Black, like they don't sell those products in their own neighborhoods, right? So it's like, how do you come and just take over and nobody does anything? So that, you know, that's why I'm big on policy. That's why I work so hard in my union, because I believe in changing things that way.
Okay, so let's get back to that, because I think the first thing that needs to happen is that people need to understand what goes on in specific communities. Like, I didn't know that that Asian beauty supply market was kind of monopolized so that Black people can't get into that market. There are, if I don't know it, and I'm up on these things pretty much, there are a lot of other people, white people out there who didn't grow up in the South Side of Chicago who also don't know that. So we're back to where we started, which is that we learn about who we are by watching television, by seeing movies. In large part, we also right now learn who we are through social media. But with this new policy coming out of the Academy, it is designed to specifically tell these stories. Yes.
I think what's interesting is that it's not even so much that it's designed to tell these stories as it's designed to force filmmakers who have traditionally told only, you know, white homogenous type stories to open up and tell stories that are more inclusive. Or to also, what's interesting is it's also about looking at who they hire, just even on the sets. Do you understand? Yeah. I mean, what kind of movie, right? You have hundreds and hundreds of people that are working behind the scenes. Those are really good jobs. Those are jobs that are union jobs. And if we can get people in those roles, that could be incredible, because that's what we're talking about. For example, we're in Los Angeles, okay? I'm in Los Angeles. And when you think of the communities out here of color, right? You have a very large, for example, Mexican population, okay? When you're looking then at a crew on a studio lot, how come those jobs are not representing the community? That's what I'm talking about. When I go to Paramount or Sony, it's majority white dudes walking around, building those sets, driving those little golf cars. They have all the jobs. And it's crazy because we're in LA. How can you have a community that does not even support, which means that the companies have to reach into the community. And it's easy to me. You start at the high schools. Mm-hmm. You start introducing this idea that, like, hey, you could come work in the studio as an electrician or as a, you know, whatever. These are good union jobs. And you'd be surprised at how many people didn't even know that that was an option. They see movies as this, like, it's a working class industry, right? It's union. So if they can come in, they get in the union, they make a great wage, they can have benefits, they can build nice lives. One of my friends who works in Disney animation, he's very big on trying to get more people of color in that, because he was like, what you have to understand, he was like, you'll have some kid, right, who's really talented, can draw whatever, but doesn't really see it as a career path, but that's exactly what it is. And so his thing is about reaching out to schools and trying to get kids who already have a natural desire and talent for drawing. He said to me, if we can get a couple of kids in from local high schools, bring them into Disney and get them into animation departments, they could work for 5 years on one movie. That's years of somebody going in every day, working, and then being able to provide for their families. And so that means that the studios, if they had it in their policy, if it's part of their, you know, company mission, like what the Academy is doing, then it forces them to get off their asses and go out into the communities and then bring people in. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. And we've been discussing this a lot at the Writers Guild since we wrote our letter that went viral back in June. And it's this, that oftentimes white people are hired based on potential and everyone else, they're hired on experience.
So I want to talk about, it's not that there are no creatives, there are no female producers, producers of color, which include females, in Los Angeles. It's just that they're not getting a seat at the table. Do you think that this will get people a seat at the table?
I think it might. I think, again, anything, first of all, let's just say the fact that we even have to do this sucks, right? Because let's just say that. It's like, I had a conversation recently with a successful white showrunner in which I had to call him out on something, and he was very uncomfortable. And I said to him, I know you're uncomfortable, but I am too, to have to sit here and have this conversation with you. Like, stop thinking that Black people aren't uncomfortable in this whole conversation either. Let's just start there. So my thing is, the fact that we have to do it, it's really a shame. But that being said, things don't change until we, go about changing them.
Right.
And like California, I think it was last year, they changed the laws when it came to boards, because they were finding there were no women of any color on any board on enough. They had to change the law. Now, if you have a board, you know, if your company in the state of California, a woman, just one has to be on the board. That's going to change the game, because it's going to have their, however you do it. And I say all that to say, I was recently asked to join an advisory board that I and another African-American woman, we are a part of. And it's interesting, because I am pretty sure if that wasn't in place, they may not have reached out to us.
Interesting. Yes. I will disagree with that law, though. I don't think that it matters if you have one woman on a board. I think that there's a tipping point. You have to have at least three. And it works. The way I've seen it is in offices. I work in journalism, and I've been in a lot of journalism offices. And if there was one office I worked in where we had eight people, and half of them were women and half of them were men. And there was a lot of stuff that went on the air, and two of us were gay. So there was a lot of stuff that went on the air that would not have gone on the air had it just been an office full of white men. And then I've been in offices where there's that one black person, right? Well, look, we hired a black person. She's sitting right over there. And then somebody does something that's pretty racist or that has a racist bent to it, and they don't realize it. And then the black person says, hey, you need to know this, which is a hard thing right there, right? You're the only person in the room, and then you have to stand up and actually call out perhaps your boss or another colleague for being ignorant. And right. Then that person is marginalized and yeah. ends up leaving. Like, we have a lot of people of color, especially, who are hired and then leave the entire profession.
I will say this. One of the things, I'm glad you mentioned that too, because we were discussing on every show, you have to hire at least one black writer. Well, we were talking to a showrunner. She says, no, that's not good enough. She said, I want them to hire one lower level and one upper level.
Yep.
And I was like, ooh, right. We have this shortage of upper level black writers because of systemic racism and being held back for so long.
Okay. So I want to ask you, we're talking about all these things that could make Hollywood better to work in and could also influence what people see on television and in films because of this new rule from the Academy. My question is the system set up to really do this in a way that makes a difference, or is it set up to just do it in a way that looks like tokenism?
I think here's the thing. We have to do something because what we're doing is not working. So I'm all for trying something and seeing how it works. You're always going to have naysayers. People protested black people being able to vote. I mean, it's kind of like, I was going to have somebody's like, well, but if we're not given the opportunity, at least let's see if being given the opportunity will work. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, but the voting thing is a really great analogy, though, because black people were given the opportunity to vote, and then from the last 50 some odd years, states have been working to take that vote away in some way, shape or form, right? The people who run the system don't really want that to happen. So that's my question. Are the people who run Hollywood, are they diversifying? Are they really, really on board with needing to diversify? Or is this just, well, this is the issue of the moment and this is what we're going to do?
Right. Because in the letter, we talked about virtue signaling performances. I think that some of them are genuinely trying to be better. Again, it's so new. I mean, even this policy, it's shifting the way producers and directors are going to look at the projects that they're going to make. Because here's the thing. You can make whatever movie you want. They're just simply saying you can't submit it to be considered for Best Picture.
Right.
I mean, ultimately, projects are made because someone wants to make the project and then someone has to believe in it enough to fund it or, you know, green light it or whatever. And that's the problem. We don't have enough black people in those roles.
Yeah.
And let's just be honest. The Oscars is a television show, right? And the ratings have been falling for years. And here's what everybody's looking at. Let's talk numbers. This country is about to be majority minority. And that's what that's why, you know, white people that are holding on to the let's make America great or whatever, yeah. That's what they're fighting against. But you can't fight it because it's already happened. As a matter of fact, last year was the first time in the history of America that the kindergarten class was majority minority. We've never had that before. So it's coming and it's coming fast. And so when that happens, it's going to change the entire population. And then you're looking at buying dollars. That's what they're looking at. They're looking at the money. For example, in 2019, there were 700 films made. And yet, Black people in the first quarter of 2019 bought 22% of those movie tickets. We did not get 22% of movies, though. Mm. We didn't get 100 new Black films in 2019. Another example, in television, there were over 500 new shows released across all platforms. Black people watch more television than any other group. We watch 50 hours a week, 10 hours more than the entire population. We didn't get, let's say, out of the 500 shows, we didn't get 100 new shows.
Yeah.
And that's not even on parity to, and so when people say, oh, it's on parity with your numbers, no. It has to be on the on the buying, because if I'm watching something on Netflix, I had to buy that subscription, right? If I'm watching television or network, that's advertisement. And I'm all of a sudden watching Domino's, now I'm going to go get me a pizza. And so advertising work for us as well. Black people have almost $3 trillion buying power. And we spend a lot of our money, just like the Latinx community spends as well. Like, we're buyers, we spend. And so we have a lot of power. And so part of it is Hollywood. It's like, look, do you want to make this money or not? You can keep playing if you want. So back to the Oscars, it's a television show that a lot of kids, because that's who they're catering to, younger adults, they don't watch it. And so they're like, why? Because like my son says, it's so, boring. It's all white. There's nothing that I want to see. So that's why they're trying to skew younger as well as more diverse, because this entire generation, and not just, kids of color, white kids are saying, enough of this.
Yeah.
I teach. I've had several of my white students say to me, I want to use my privilege to dismantle systemic racism.
What you're talking about here, it seems to me, is this the audience development part of the piece? Because that's the part that very much confuses me. What audience are they looking to develop?
Let's say I have a production company and I have 10 projects that I'm considering, and only one, let's say one of them is about a queer person, one is about maybe someone with a disability, I have two or three that are about people of color, and the others are all, let's say more, white male. I'm more than likely going to look closer at those other projects now, because this isn't just about, isn't just looking at, people of color. It's also about other stories. I was on a Zoom call yesterday with some students from UCLA, and one of the students was disabled in a wheelchair, and he pitched this incredible story about a hero who was wheelchair bound. I didn't even think about that. That's what I'm saying. Like, it forces you, I think, to think differently. And I think that's what makes it exciting. They'll have to look at projects they may have slept on before, or they disregarded. Or let's say, I remember when I moved here and I interned for Will Smith. Will Smith had tons of projects that he was trying to get off the ground, and he was being told no too. So what's going to happen, I think, is a lot of those projects might get another look. I don't know if you saw, but last week, Reggie Hudlin, who's actually the first Black producer for the Emmys this year, which is incredible that all this time later, we just have the first Black producer. But he was recently given a green light to reboot these Black characters from the Marvel world that he had worked on years ago, but then eventually they shelved. And now they're bringing these characters back out. So Marvel had an entire world of Black characters already developed.
Wow.
But the industry's not ready for it. And I'm just so happy that iconic filmmakers like Reggie Hudlin are given another chance. That's what I'm saying. So he was already doing the work. He also was instrumental, a lot of people may not know this, but he was instrumental in a lot of the development that came out in the Black Panther movie, because he made a lot of changes years ago in the actual comic book series where he developed out the women. And that's why those women were so badass.
Yeah.
Because as we all know, when Chadwick, when he passed, everybody was like so devastated in the Black community. I mean, I literally had to lie down that day because when I didn't know he was sick, I was really sad. But I told my husband, I said, it feels like we really lost someone special to us as a Black community, because he gave us our first real Black superhero.
Yeah.
Someone that we could be so proud of. And it was someone that, just represented Black people in such a dope way. And what I loved is that he wasn't perfect, and the world wasn't perfect, and his dad made some bad choices, and his cousin was struggling, but it was just beautiful. It was a beautiful story. Yeah. And those things matter too. So even if it never got an award, the impact is so incredible and great. Because here's the thing, it's not just a little Black kid looking at Black Panther, it's every little kid looking at Black Panther.
Yes, yes.
It normalizes the hero. And it's just like, of course he can be a hero. Yes. Of course. And as a Black woman, I'm waiting on the first Black woman. We got Wonder Woman. She did it. Now, we have Black Panther. I'd like to see a Black woman be able to, star in and be a hero just like those characters.
Another episode of Impact has come and gone. Impact is a co-production of Nevada Voice and KUNV. You can find the show and individual clips via our podcast, which is linked to KUNV.org. Thanks to Peter Guzman and Michelle Amor-Gillies for talking to me this week. Thanks to Lisa Mosley for that wonderful opening discussion. Of course, our intro music is Foster the People's Life on the Nickel, and you're listening right now to Vampire Weekend's Oxford Comma. We'll be back next week. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Thank you for listening to Impact.